let me try and answer that briefly. What the Michael Mann work purported to do was to give an average global temperature. It did not distinguish between various latitudes. It did not distinguish between, and this was global surface temperature. Now, there are historical measurements dating from about 1850 that show the average temperature has risen from 1850 till the present day by about 0.8 degrees centigrade plus or minus 1 degree centigrade. So the global average temperature has not changed very much. What we had asserted in our testimony was that this was not a very good indicator of what the temperature was really doing, because it's highly localized, as Doug will probably show you momentarily. There are models that are much more geospatially distributed, and so the hockey stick, to be honest, became the showpiece for the IPCC 2001 report. It was widely distributed around the world, and it was in some sense politically correct, but it wasn't very good science. That was the bottom line. So Richard will show you, I think, we'll talk about higher level altitude temperatures. Doug will show you, I think, some things on more global climate models. Okay. Yes? I'm sorry, between what? In terms of the, I think very briefly, in terms of, I think the multivariate approach for PCA, it is essentially assumed, I think, that the proxies are functioning independently of each other. If that's the case, then the covariance matrix among the proxies is going to be essentially zero, and so centering and Mahalanobis distance would have essentially the same effect. Okay.
So our next speaker is Doug Nijka. He's the director of the Institute for Mathematics Applied to Geosciences.
That's right.
I think I wasn't sure if it was geosciences or geostatistics. At NCAR, Dr. Nijka is very well respected in the climate change community. He's got some really good research going on how to do climate modeling, and this is actually a really nice video. So please.
Okay. Thanks a lot, and thanks for coming. To, I think, a little bit different series of talks than you might have in the rest of the meetings. This is an animation of the NCAR climate model. I'll be talking a little bit about what climate models are in my talk. But I just wanted to show this animation to give you a feeling of how much detail these things are. This is a particularly high resolution. Many of the experiments are not run this high, but in particular, this model has resolution that's detailed enough to produce hurricanes, or in the Pacific they're called typhoons. And so you can see sort of one now sort of forming and coming and sort of crashing into sort of Korea there. And anyway, so it's sort of interesting and gives you an idea of how realistic these are. Okay, so go into my talk here. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about what's known about climate change, the role of models, and then I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about paleoclimate and sort of sort of flesh out some of the stuff that Ed has already talked about. There was some confusing instructions for me about disclosing conflicts of interest. I do not work for a drug company, so I don't think there's any problems here. But okay. So first of all, just so that we're all grounded, what is climate? Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you actually get. And so if we look over on the left-hand side there, we see a thunderstorm. That's weather. If you actually look at that vegetation, you can see that it's sagebrush, and that probably gives you an idea of what the climate is here, that on the average, it probably doesn't get a whole lot of precipitation. You can, if you look over on the right side, you can see that there's this fellow standing in front of his house. He's up to his waist in water. Clearly, there was an unusual rainfall here. Climate would talk about how often you see those. So what's important here is that a climate is an average. And just as sort of a working definition of what climate is, typically people in this area take a 30-year average of something. So if we took a 30-year average of daytime temperatures on a certain day of the year in San Diego, we would say that's an estimate of the climate. Climate change, if you're starting to understand this, is a bit of an oxymoron, because if climate is a long-term stationary average, how can it change? Well, the idea is that when we use that 30-year working definition, really what we're talking about is a 30-year window. And as we slide that window a long time, we actually see subtle variations. And that's the climate change we're talking about. Okay. Well, just so that we're all grounded, what is uncertainty? I wasn't quite sure of the audience here. And for all the statisticians, I apologize about going back to Stat 101. But the way statisticians try to describe uncertainty, and actually what's becomes very convenient even in very sophisticated computations, is to generate what's called in the geosciences an ensemble. An ensemble of states is a way to describe the variation and the uncertainty among them. So what I have over here is 100 weddings. This is actually a work of art. Jason Salavon is a digital artist who has a series of pieces called 100 Special Moments. And some of these, he includes weddings. He also has Santas. There are also some things that I can't really talk about in public that he has as 100 Special Moments. But anyway, what he does is, this is actually his work over here. It's sort of an average of these weddings, or if you want, an estimate of central tendency. And so what's going on here? Well, that blurred image you see really is the best single description of this sample of 100. It doesn't give you an idea of the variability of this. It doesn't give you an idea of the richness of what all these images look like. The other important thing about that average wedding couple is that it doesn't look like an average wedding couple. And so the other point is that the average doesn't always look like a sample drawn from that population. And I think this makes it very clear. My big objection initially to all of Mann's work, and in general that paleoclimate community, is that they were focusing on the average wedding, showing that, trying to draw conclusions from it, and not really spending too much time to think about, well, what are the hundred weddings that we're actually drawing this from? What's our population? What is our uncertainty? And so the way I'm going to end this talk is to actually give you an idea of how a statistician may redo that hockey stick and revisit it and give you an idea of sort of what the uncertainty is in that. Okay. But before we do that, let me just tell you a little bit about what's known about climate change. And I think that this must resonate quite a bit in public health. There are some areas where there are very sort of well-formed opinions. The community feels fairly certain about them. As you talk about details and fine gradations and maybe ask about particular subpopulations or specific patients, things become more uncertain. And that's exactly how it is in the climate arena. When we talk about the global average temperature, there are things that are fairly well accepted. And I'm just sort of referencing the latest report that was produced by the intergovernment panel on climate change. And here's a quote that I pulled out of the executive summary. Most of the observed increase in global average temperatures since the mid-20th century is very likely due to the observed increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. So anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations is really largely saying the CO2 released by humans due to industrial activity, mainly due to fossil fuel use. Okay, so, and all of these words were very carefully measured in this statement. Global average temperature, not precipitation over San Diego. Very likely due. They actually set very likely to have a very specific probability range in terms of what they mean. But this particular conclusion is very well established, very well documented among the climate science community. Okay, so backing off from that, what will happen in the future? There's uncertainty about that. As we go down to regional scales, there's more uncertainty too. Okay, but in terms of this particular conclusion, I wanted to give you an idea of how it's arrived at. And what's interesting about this to me is that it really hinges on being able to model climate. It's really hard to get around to reach a conclusion like this without doing that modeling. And essentially, the way they arrive at this is simply a very simple experiment where they take a group of climate models and they run them without the CO2 and other greenhouse gases produced by humans. And they can do this because this is a model. And they get this range of blue results here in terms of global average temperature. The pink are the models running with greenhouse gases, and then the black here is the observed global temperature average. It's very difficult to construct a climate model that will achieve this kind of result if you don't add in the greenhouse gases produced by humans. Okay, so this is a... I don't know what you want to call this. This is sort of an A and B treatment. It's sort of a two-factor kind of numerical experiment. And there are many variations of doing this. These particular results are results from very complicated climate models, but even simple climate models will give you this same kind of result. Now, what's important about this, and it's another way of framing Ed's description about the hockey stick, is that I haven't said anything about what temperatures are doing for the past 1,000 years. What we're really trying to do is use modeling to assess a cause and effect. To reach this kind of conclusion, we don't have to go farther back than the beginning of the last century to reach this. Okay, so this is all about climate models. What are they? They're basically computer codes that are trying to incorporate as much physical understanding as possible to simulate the Earth system. Once you have this, you can use various kinds of variations on this. You can change the amount of gases that are included. You can also run these forward into the future with prescribed different levels of CO2 to see what happens. And so when you see these projected possible changes, those are done from running these same climate models, not over the last century, to see how well they match what's been observed, but you run them forward to try to predict what will happen. Okay, these are very big models, and they're very complex. They essentially synthesize the understanding of entire fields within the computer codes. So first of all, they're global. They cover the atmosphere, including the clouds and land surface interaction. An important part of the models is something called convection, which is a sort of thunderstorms, particularly over in the tropics and over the oceans. These kinds of thunderstorms are really important in terms of how the Earth balances its energy. There's also land-ocean interactions, and there's a whole ocean component for climate models, which produces the long-term memory in the system. There's also ice models. You've probably heard a lot about ice. And in fact, the climate models did not predict did not predict the break of the ice as quickly as it's been observed, and that could just be that the ice models are not as good as they could be, and there's also vegetation. This is kudzu, by the way. I also put this in just to say another component of the climate models is also human influences. And when I was in North Carolina, it was very clear that kudzu was a human influence. It was originally, I think, imported from Japan. Okay, the computers, they're huge. This is a picture of the old NCAR computer, and it basically fills a room about half this size. We also need very large tape and disk storage to store the results. And then this is just to remind you of that animation that I produced. Okay. And I should say, even though this animation was sort of a high-end simulation, it's still only at a resolution on the order of about, let me see here, I'm bad at doing arithmetic in my head, but it's going to be about 40-kilometer resolution. So what that means is that despite the realism of that simulation, it's representing a square 40 kilometers on a side as a single point. So if you think of a city, say like Washington or New York, it's just a single point. That is, there's a surface temperature that represents the entire grid area. So there's still a lot to be done there, and so I guess just rounding out this little section before I talk about paleoclimate, is to say that there are some things that are very well known at a global scale. We've seen warming; it's attributable at least in part to CO2. We expect that to be continuing. There's a commitment to warming, no matter what we do now, because of the inertia in the system, that things will continue warming even if we stop adding more CO2 to the atmosphere. The other thing that's worrisome is that our rates of CO2 release are actually increasing quicker than is projected. So some of the computer codes that are include forecasts of future CO2 emissions are actually conservative in terms of what the trends seem to be. So that's all at a global scale. At a regional scale, it becomes much more uncertain. And certainly at a scale where you'd want to use future climate information to make public health decisions or try to talk about different kinds of diseases that are carried by insects or depend on certain kinds of moisture or temperature, that becomes much more difficult. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to look at that, but we should be very careful to try to quantify the uncertainties in making those kinds of judgments. And really, just to round out this section, I would go back to those 100 wedding couples. And in the analysis here, what I would demand is, Don't just show me the average wedding of your analysis, but also show me those 100 weddings so I can see what the true variability is in these. And I think had man perhaps done that correctly with the original hockey stick, maybe a lot of this would have been missed. Okay, so I do want to talk a little bit about paleoclimate. I'm going to focus on estimating the northern hemisphere annual temperatures. So this is a hemispheric average. Really, the work done on this is Bo Lee, who was at NCAR and is now at Purdue, and Caspar Amann, who's a paleoclimatologist at NCAR. Recapping a little bit of what Ed had to say, if we're going back in time when there weren't thermometers, we have to find proxies for those. These can be tree rings. They can be sediments found in lakes or pollen. They can also involve ice cores. And then there's also an interesting climate measurement that is simply measuring the temperature at depth in deep wells through solid rock. It's called a borehole measurement, and it has the potential to give temperatures fairly far back, and they're fairly accurate because they really are a temperature measurement. Okay, so the basic strategy here to use these proxies for temperature. Are we essentially try to calibrate the relationship between temperature and the proxies when we have both of them measured, and then we predict temperature from the proxies back in earlier years. That's essentially what man attempted to do. I'm going to give a little bit of a different slant on that, and this is as a statistician revisiting this. One of our goals, as I've said, is that whatever we do, we want to represent what we've come up with by an ensemble so that we can represent uncertainties. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to generate the ensemble members. These are all going to look like hypothetical past temperatures, hypothetical past hockey sticks, and I can generate a sample of these using Monte Carlo. They'll all be equally likely given the data, and so the interpretation there is I can use those as a sample and calculate statistics on them, like the mean and the variance and quantiles, and this will give me an idea of my uncertainty. Technically, how we do that is something called a Bayesian hierarchical model, and this also has the potential to combine lots of different kinds of proxies rather than just tree rings. Okay, so the hierarchical model, I would guess that in many public health, in several public health applications, this is also made in inroads. It's a nice way of communicating with scientists about processes. It's also a nice way of disentangling sort of effects due to observing a process as opposed to the process itself. And so very briefly here without formulas, the hierarchical model has a relationship of the proxies to surface temperatures. So what we're doing here is saying if we knew the true northern hemisphere temperature, how we would expect a tree ring to respond. Or how would we expect an index of tree rings or pollens to respond? And then at another level, we also have to have a statistical model for how we think temperatures behave over time. Not exactly their mean, but how they may be varied in terms of correlations between years, and also if they're how they may depend on other covariates that we have. And then finally, since this is a Bayesian model, we also have a prior on the statistics parameters. Although these priors tend not to be too important or informative in this case. Okay, so here's the big difference between what we're doing and what previous paleoclimate reconstructions have done. What actually drives climate? Well, it's these forcings. In our recent past, it's been CO2 that's been omitted by human activities. But historically, there's always been greenhouse gases. There's been different kinds of aerosols, and especially volcanic eruptions have affected that. There's also variation in the intensity of the sun, which also affects climate. And these are fairly on. People are able to create estimates of what these different kinds of forcings are for climate back in time. So the purple is due to known volcanic eruptions. The blue is an estimate of how the sun has been changing over the past 1,000 years. And then the red curve here is CO2, which can be recovered from air bubbles and ice cores. And then what we have here, that this black is a composite of all these. So this is a covariate for climate, if you will, that has been generated in the absence of looking at temperature data, looking at other proxy data. And the difference between our analysis and man is that we're actually going to use this in the analysis. It'll help in terms of setting sort of what we know physically. In terms of how, at a global scale at least, what climate responds to. Okay, so I'm going to skip the math here and go right on to the results. So what do we have? We have the climate proxies, which man used, which are mainly tree rings, some sort of lake sediment data. We're using these forcings, which we have, which are trying to describe and aggregate how the climate system responds to things like volcanic eruptions and the sun. And here's our version of the hockey stick. And I apologize in terms of the shortness of the time. I didn't generate my hundred special hockey stick moments here. But what I have done is trying to give you an idea of what the variability of those may look like. The red is the observed temperature series. The blue here is the mean of 1,000 possible reconstructions of this past temperature. And the gray gives you a feeling for what the range is for 95% of those 1,000, so the 950. Now, what I did was, it turned out a detail of Mann's conclusions was that he actually talked about the maximum decade, the maximum decadal temperature, and how that compares to the current. And so what I did, just to show you the power of these ensembles, is I simply went through the 1,000 cases, and I found out where it has its decadal maxima, and that's these pink dots, and I've summarized those by box plots. And then I've aggregated all of those decadal maxima together in a single box plot here. And so what I have here now is a distribution of decadal maximum temperatures, so 10-year average temperatures, the maximum over the past the past values before we had temperatures. And here's an estimate of that distribution. Here's the 95% line for that. And if we draw that across, what we see is that there's evidence here to say that the recent temperatures, the recent decadal mean temperatures for the northern hemisphere, have been higher than what we might expect in the past. So let me make two points about this. One is obvious: is that we have a statistical model. We're trying to do the uncertainty carefully. Clearly, I had a mouthful of words to try to explain this. But nevertheless, we have this methodology that is sound. We can debate the assumptions of this, but at least the assumptions are clear in the analysis. The other point I wanted to make is really just a point about science, and it's something that Ed brought up too, is that if we really want to talk about attribution of human activities to this rise in temperature, it's probably not as good a science to look back at this and talk about saying, well, it's been very cool in the past and now it's very warm, so we must be doing something bad. Really the attribution hinges on actually looking at a model and saying, beyond just a correlation, here is a model that documents a physical relationship between increased CO2 and increased warming. We can also scrutinize that model and debate it, but at least that's a direct scientific connection. And I'm sure you can all appreciate that difference. Okay, so that's all I have to say. It's useful to focus on a forward observational model when we're using proxies and also include a physical process. What we found is that including this forcing model can include all kinds of reasonable constraints that improve our analysis. And then finally, putting this in a Bayesian context is an unambiguous method for trying to generate statistical ensembles. Thanks a lot.